This is day one of the 2016 Idlewild Bible School. Our second period teacher is Brother Simon O'Grady. His general topic is Daniel narratives. Today's topic is Great Babylon. Brother Simon.
Thank you, Brother Chair, and good morning, brothers and sisters. Really is. I've heard that's a tradition here. We have Brother Ben Brinkerhoff back in New Zealand, and he starts off every study with good morning and then waits and waits and waits. Look, it really is lovely to be with you this week and to share together the blessings of the truth that we hold dear. Now, I thought I'd start with just a very quick introduction because it's, I think, 4 or 5 years ago I was in California, the California conference, and while I've been on the East Coast, I haven't been on the West Coast very often. So while there's a few familiar faces, many are new and you probably don't know me. So I'll give you a quick little introduction. So I'm here with my wife, Sister Cindy, who's here in the second row in front, and our four children, Jamie, Sister Jamie, Sister Bethany, who are 20 and 19. Jamie will have her 21st birthday at the school. She didn't want me to tell you that, but I have. I'm sure we'll sing a happy birthday. And Danielle, who's 15, and Joseph, who's 11, the full stop, the boy in the family. Now, I thought I would start with this particular, very important picture here. Now, many of them, you probably can't see this from the back. Hopefully you can. Now, I understand many Americans are geographically challenged, and in the last 2 weeks, we actually came over earlier because of school holidays, and I was at the Grand Canyon and on the south side at the shop there, and the lady who was serving asked me where I was from, and I said, from New Zealand, and she says, oh, I've always wanted to visit Australia. And then 2 days later in Monument Valley, we were doing a little tour with one of the local Navajo guides there, and he said, where are you from? We said, New Zealand. He said, oh, very, very cold there, isn't it? I said, oh, really, it's quite mild. He said, well, I've never been to Alaska, but I'm sure it's as old. So, for those who didn't know, on the left, this is Australia, and New Zealand is not Australia. It's these two little islands in the middle there. Now, here's a picture of it. Two islands, the North Island and the South Island. Now, there's a three-hour ferry trip, a rail ferry and a car ferry trip between the two islands. It's about two-thirds the size of the California state in terms of land area. So it's a fairly small country. There's only 4 to 4.5 million Kiwis or New Zealanders. But the length is about the length of the California state and also Oregon, if I pronounce that right. So it's quite long and drawn out. Now, the truth's been in New Zealand for now over 150 years. They're brethren and sisters from one end of this country to the other. There's about 25 different ecclesias of different sizes. And we have Bible schools there as well, annual Bible schools. There are three Bible schools are run, one in winter and two in summer, one in the North Island and one in the South Island, and a very active youth group and conferences and youth conferences and CYC groups. New Zealand, of course, is renowned for its beauty. Here's just a quick little snapshot of some of the pictures there. A very beautiful and a diverse country, ranging from almost tropical right in the very north to almost in the South Pole down at Invercargill. I believe Brother Rob Oosthuizen has been here over the last number of years. I caught up on him at the end of the year. He was regaling me with stories of how wonderful this Bible school was. And they, of course, live right at the very bottom of the South Island. Invercargill, next stop is the South Pole. In fact, I've often quoted Invercargill as a fulfillment of Bible prophecy in Acts chapter 1, where the truth was to go out to the uttermost parts of the earth. And truly, Invercargill is the furthest geographically from Jerusalem you can get, where there are brethren and sisters. So fulfillment of Bible prophecy, very auspicious place. So hopefully that's a quick little snapshot of New Zealand, where we come from. Very much looking forward to getting to know you all. If you see us or my children wandering around, just say hello and introduce yourself. All right, well, today we're going to have a look at the subject of Great Babylon. We're going to look at the book of Daniel, but we're going to focus not on the prophecies, but on the narratives, the stories of the book of Daniel. Daniel's a fascinating book. You know, we all know that it's a foundation of Bible prophecy, but it contains in the first 7 chapters these incredible stories. They're just simply awesome. They're the stuff of Sunday school epics and plays. Not really epics, plays, but Daniel in the Lion's Den, the burning fiery furnace, great image nightmares, spooky hands writing on the walls, and all revolving around what starts in Daniel chapter 1 as a young teenager, somewhere in his mid-teens, 15, 16 years old, and his three teenage friends, right in the halls of the world's greatest empire at the time. And we're going to have a look at the stories of Daniel this week, the narratives of the book of Daniel. And we're going to take what we'll call a thematic approach. That means we're going to look at the thematic anchors, the structures, the biblical context of these narratives, and we're going to see them grow and then spread across Scripture in a beautiful way, while also identifying the moral lessons and meanings for us. We're going to mix it up a little bit, so in sessions 4 and 5 particularly, you're going to do a lot of the work. We're going to do some colouring in, we're going to do some Bible study process, and so you'll need to bring some colouring in pencils and pens to our 4th and 5th study. But this morning we're going to have a look at the historical setting of the book of Daniel, because an understanding of historical setting, both geographically and politically and religiously, is going to help us understand the background and the meaning of the stories and narratives in these books. So really we're going to do 3 things this morning. We're going to have a look at the biblical perspective in a moment, 5 or 10 minutes, in terms of the founding principles of Babylon. So in the mind of God, when he looks at Babylon, what does he think it is? Then we're going to have a look at the historical context of the empire of Babylon that finishes or arises in Daniel chapter 1. So we're going to cover very quickly nearly 2,000 years of history. So those who love history are going to be delighted. Those who don't, well, pop out and grab a coffee or something at time. And then finally, we're going to have a look at the religion of Babylon, because the religion of Babylon features very prominently in terms of the narratives and stories in the book of Daniel. So biblical perspective, historical context, and the religion is our journey this morning. It's into this that these 4 teenagers, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, are thrust in the first chapter of the book. Now the thematic, the biblical setting of the book of Daniel starts all the way back in Genesis chapter 11. So let's go back to the founding of Babylon and the Tower of Babel story in Genesis chapter 10 and 11, and we're going to have a look at the founding principles of Babylon, and they carry on all the way through the scriptures. Now here in chapter 10 and 11 of Genesis, it, of course, is the story and record of how the nations began to disperse out into the world after the flood and the founding of the Tower of Babel. Now, as we read this, just see how beautifully and very economically, as the word typically does, sets out the founding principles, the driving ideas of Babylon here in the text. So in chapter 11 of Genesis, in verse 1, we read, "The whole earth was one language, one speech." So the story of Babylon begins in unity. One language, one speech. And it's going to become a theme now in these next few verses. Verse 2, "It came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there." Now just put a little note in your margin, Daniel 1 verse 2, Shinar is the land of Babylon. Now just watch the emphasis now on us, we, togetherness and unity. Verse 3, "They said one to another, go to, let us make brick and burn them throughly. And they had brick for stone, slime had they for mortar." Verse 4, "They said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach to heaven. Let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." But far from unity, of course, it all ends in confusion and scattering, because God, in verse 8, scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore, the name of it is called Babel, or Babylon, confusion, because Yahweh did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did Yahweh scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. So here we go on the screen. The founding principles of Babylon were these: let us make and build a name, a city, a tower to the top, to the heavens, to achieve a unity and universality of people. And now wherever you find Babylon in the scriptures, you will find pride, human-centeredness, the making and building of names and cities and heights and attaining of the heavens, a gathering of lots of people together who are attracted to its unity and its universality and its humanism. And the spirit of Babylon is epitomized here, and I'll put them on the screen, in the words of Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4, verse 30, where he says, "Is not this great Babylon? I have built it for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power, the honor of my majesty." So that it captures, in an essence, the spirit of Babylon. And while that spirit, of course, has gone through multiple manifestations throughout Scripture and throughout time, it lives on today. Just have a look at this. Here's a few pictures of many of the main cities of the world, including a few chucked in there from New Zealand. You'll even see Los Angeles skyline in there. What do you notice? Wherever man gathers together and creates a city, they create towers. And if you ever go at night and see any one of these and watch the skyline, of course, all the towers have names written across it. So the spirit of Babylon lives on in the kingdoms of men that we see today. So that's the founding of Babylon, right back in Genesis chapter 11. We're going to see that these themes run through the narratives and the stories of the book of Daniel. All right, take a deep breath, because now we're going to start the history section. And we're going to run pretty quickly from the founding of Babel all the way through to Daniel chapter 1. So while the people were scattered here from Babylon by God, by a confusion of languages, there was one group who did not leave Shinar or Babylon, and they stayed and they founded a kingdom there, the kingdom of Babylon, in the land of Shinar. Now we find that group one chapter earlier in chapter 10. So have a look at Genesis chapter 10, where it records what happened after Babel, and it records the division and the movements of people out away from Shinar and away from Babylon. So in Genesis chapter 10, verse 1, it begins, "These are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, Japheth. To them sons were born after the flood." And the chapter neatly divides structurally into these three groupings, those of Shem, those of Ham, those of Japheth. And in verse 6 to 10, we have the sons of Ham. And in verse 6, it says, "The sons of Ham, Cush, Mitzrayim, Phut, and Canaan." And in verse 8, we get to Nimrod, son of Cush, who says in verse 8, "Began to be a mighty one on the earth, a mighty hunter before God." In verse 10, it says that Nimrod founded Babylon. Verse 10, Genesis 10, "The beginning of his," Nimrod's kingdom, "was Babel," that's Babylon, "and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar." So let's take a look here on the screen on a map, and I know it's very small, so apologies for that, at those towns or cities. So here we have a picture, of course, of the Middle East. And in that red circle and their red dots is the founding of the kingdom of Babylon in the land of Shinar, Babylon, Akkad, Erech, and Calneh. So that's where Nimrod founded the kingdom of Babylon, right back in the beginning. And they settled in that middle area, fertile area, the floodplains, which became known as the land of Shinar. Now in verse 11, those from Shem left Shinar. There's a little bit of dispute about what the exact Hebrew wording means here, but I think it means that Shem left the area of Shinar. In verse 10, "Out of the land of Shinar went forth Asher, who was a Semite, and built Nineveh, the city of Rehoboth and Calah, that became Semite kingdoms." Now Asher is not Hamite, he's Shem, from Shem, verse 22. So they built Nineveh, Rehoboth and Calah in the north there in that blue circle. But there was one group of Semites or Shemites who went south. They were called the Elamites, and they ended up down there in the lower blue circle in the river delta area, right in the northern part of the Persian Gulf. They settled in the swampy marsh-like areas of the delta of the Euphrates and the Tigris, and that land of Elam contained, as you can see, the city of Ur. In fact, Ur was virtually a coastal city. Most of that area that you can see on the map from Ur down to Persian Gulf has all been filled in over the subsequent thousands of years. So Ur was in the land of Elam in the southern area, populated by descendants of Shem. Now just remember, make a mental note of the Elamites. because many centuries later, the Elamites are going to become key players in the story of Babylon and Daniel. Now, in addition, verse 21 in Genesis 10 makes a point that to Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder, to him were children born. So Shem is the father of all the children of Eber. Now, that's important because Eber means to be on the other side, to be on the other side of the river, and hence the derivation of the term Hebrew, one who crosses over from the other side of the river, and therefore became the name of the descendants of Abraham who left the land of their forefathers and crossed over the river, becoming Hebrews. Now, this morning we're going to focus on these two groups. We're going to focus on the red circled land of Shinar, where the very ancient city of Babylon was founded by Nimrod on those lower floodplains of the Euphrates and Tigris. And we're going to focus on the blue circled areas, that in the north that became known as Assyria, from Asher, son of Shem, and the blue area circled down in the lower part, in the sea and delta, the land of Elam, also a son of Shem, and it includes the ancient city of Ur. Now, over the next 1,000 years or so, these little settlements formed the foundation of what became known as the Sumerian or the ancient Mesopotamian civilizations. And I'm going to spend 5 to 10 minutes now just describing to you what happened as these civilizations began to develop in what is known today as the cradle of civilization. So for the next 1,000 years or so, from Genesis chapter 10 and 11, in those days, and it remains true today, nations arise and become powerful when groups of people coalesce and get together. It all started when you had individual little families that began to expand. They became tribal groupings, much like Christadelphia, I guess, as families expand and become tribes. Those groupings would then start to increase in numbers, and generally speaking, the more people you had, then the more power you had, because you had more soldiers to fight. So people ended up clumping together in these little groups, mainly on the basis of three things. Family. Families grew. They spread. They expanded. They become tribes. They gathered together because of the availability of food. So where there were local food sources, people began to coalesce. And the other one was wealth. Now, wealth is mainly accumulated, economically speaking, through four main sources. Either you get it because you have resources, because your country just happens to have things like gold and silver and energy sources like timber or foods. So you get wealth because you have resources. Or you are a manufacturer. You're really, really good at making things and then selling them. So countries like Japan or China, which are relatively resource poor, have specialized in making things and selling them. The third way was that you would do trade. Now, of course, that was the foundation of the establishment of the British Empire. You'd buy things from one party and you'd flog it off to another for a higher price, and the difference was your profit, and so you became wealthy because of the money you made. Or the last one, also a bit of a, how many English people are there in the audience? You stole it or pillaged it off someone else who had the resources or the trades or could make things. That was a bit unfair. Now, the thing about money or wealth as you began to accumulate and create it was that it gave you power. It allowed you to buy things, and most particularly, you could buy mercenary soldiers. So you could fund and create an army and therefore defend yourself and attack others. And that's exactly what happened in those days. So as time went through, they began to accumulate wealth through resources, labor, trade, and pillaging, and the populations began to increase into these little city-states, all established over the Mesopotamia area. Now, they're little city-states because really they're only 10 to 30,000 clusters of people. They would live in a small city, they'd put a wall around themselves, they'd create an army. Down the road, there'd be another city-state. Up the river, there'd be another one. And for about 1,000 years, it was just a constant moving group of these city-states and alignments between different city-states and areas. Every one of them contained this little group of people, based often on some tribal grouping originally, that accumulated wealth, built its little army. Each one had its king, if you can call ruling 20 or 30,000 people a king. They had its own aristocracy, its nobility began to develop, bunch of alliances. It was like a massive real-life game of civilization or Age of Empires. You build alliances with the people next door or across the river or up in the mountains so that they'd come and help you if you were attacked, and you would help them if they were attacked. So there's a whole mix of politics and strategic alliances to try and keep your city-state alive and prosperous. Now, at some point, the kings fell on a solution that if you wanted to form alliances, then one of the very best ways was to marry the sister, daughter, niece, or cousin of the king of the next guy down the river. So it was not unusual for kings to have whole palaces full of wives and concubines. There were all sorts of insurance policies. Brother Jeff, it would be quite difficult, wouldn't it, to sell insurance back in those days. So all sorts of insurance policies in terms of those alliances. Now, from time to time, a city-state would become weak. There'd be a famine, there'd become some disease, or there'd be some change in economics or internal structures or fighting inside. And so the next door neighbor will come in and pillage you and take your city or your village and begin to expand. So that's what happened for nearly 1,000 years. There were not really any empires to speak of for all that period of time. Now, every one of these cities would then develop their own tribal gods. Often families would have their own family god, often ancestral. But there were developing over these 1,000 years or so these major gods that everybody from one end of Mesopotamia to the other end began to worship. They were universal gods, and they began to aggregate all the family god-type characteristics. There were literally thousands of these little gods and goddesses worshipped by everybody through the Euphrates, but over this period of time, it coalesced into some main worships, and we're going to see that shortly. Right, well, that's ancient Mesopotamia, really, in a nutshell. We haven't really done it justice, but you can see the picture of how things began to develop over that period of time after Genesis chapter 10, 11. Now, the reason why we're looking at this in terms of Babylon is that for most of its history, Babylon was just one of these little city-states. You know, we often have this picture of Babylon as this great empire, and in a certain phase it was, but for a very short period of time. For most of its existence, it was just a little city-state, and it came and went, and it changed hands, and it changed alliances like all the others, based initially on this tribal grouping. But they began to morph and develop a religious framework. You know, Babylon actually went through 8 different sets of hands and peoples and nations in its history. So by the time we get to the book of Daniel, Babylon literally, by its development of its religions, had become a center of a mother of abominations and idolatrous practices of the Mesopotamian earth. It was the center of worship, as we're going to see in a moment, of the two principal gods, Marduk and Shin. Now, you'll recall in Scripture that the Babylonians are connected with a group of people called the Chaldeans. So much so that later on the term Chaldeans is used almost interchangeably with the term Babylonian. Now, the Chaldeans are a little obscure. Historians don't really know exactly where they come from, except it is very clear that they arose out of that bottom blue oval area, the land of Elam, and that they were culturally and probably genetically connected to the Elamites. And they were known in history as the Chaldu, from whom the Chaldeans were derived. Now, they inhabited this black oval here, and you'll notice that it also included the area of Ur. They were originally a very obscure and little heard of people, and that's why the historians have trouble actually finding out where they came from. Now, the name Chaldean literally means the clay breakers, clay or clod breakers, because they were an agricultural people. They lived down in the delta regions, they broke up the clay and the clods, they planted crops, and they were also herdsmen, well known as herdsmen, who ran vast herds of animals and beasts and cows and sheep and goats in these well-watered plainlands of the lower delta. So their patron god was Nana, often called Shin, who's the god of cows and also the god of the moon. So the patron god of Ur in the south, and funnily enough, also of Hayran way up in the north, is Shin, the god of cattle and herdsmen and of the moon. So the Chaldeans are the small sub-tribe, herdsmen, farmers, and they began to become powerful and wealthy in the south, largely because they controlled the city of Ur, and Ur was a major trading city on the river Euphrates, or the delta of the Tigris and the Euphrates, an entrance to the Persian Gulf. All right, well, that's pretty much what life was like living before the time of Abraham and the development of those city-states and development of the peoples over 1,000 years or so. We're going to move all the way through now to BC 1200. Now, keep in mind, BC 1800, 600 years before, is the time of Abraham. That's when he left Ur. So 600 years after Abraham, some of these city-states in the north began to coalesce around Asher and Nineveh and become systematically more powerful. They began to take other cities militarily. They began to control them. They put their own people in power. And over a period of time, for the very first time in history, a true empire, the Assyrian Empire, began to develop in the north. It was the first time in 1,000 years that a group of people had managed to get together a coalition and a power base to be called a true empire. Thank you. Now, here's a picture of the Assyrian Empire at its zenith, at its epoch. Now, we normally read about this Assyrian Empire in the Bible in relation to the nation of Israel and the land of Israel. But, you know, Assyria ruled all of that area, all of those city-states, and it ruled by putting vassal rulers in place for about 600 years. So the way Assyrians worked, they'd come and they'd take your city. They'd then go and put one of their own guys in charge. If you didn't like it, they'd wipe you out. So they had quite a method, and it was quite persuasive. And with that method, they built this enormous empire. It lasted for about 600 years. And for about 600 years, Babylon, way down there in the south, was actually an Assyrian city ruled by vassal rulers of the Assyrian power in the north. Now, we're going to move all the way down now to the last 80 years or so of the Assyrian Empire. So it lasted for 600 years. We're going to move all the way down now to the last 80 years because it's going to start getting us down into the context of Daniel and the rise of the Chaldeans in Babylon. Now, we're going to start in BC 710. So by now, the Assyrians have been in power for nearly 600 years. In BC 710, there was a vassal king called Merodach-Baladan down there in Babylon. So he's a local king of Babylon. He's not Assyrian, but he rules because Assyria has given him permission as a vassal king. And he begins a plot against the Assyrian power in the north. Now, we read about this in the Bible because Merodach-Baladan actually sends an embassy or an ambassage all the way across to Hezekiah, because he'd heard that Hezekiah had been sick, and give him a get-well card. Now, come with me to Isaiah chapter 39, because this is where we read of the ambassage of Merodach-Baladan over there in Babylon, a vassal king to Assyria, who's beginning an insurrection. And he sends this ambassage over to Hezekiah. Now, we learn of the fact that he set up a rebellion through secular history. Hezekiah was not the only person to whom Merodach-Baladan sent ambassadors. In fact, he sent them all over the Assyrian or southern part of the Assyrian Empire. In Isaiah 39, verse 1, at that time, Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he had heard that he had been sick and was recovered. Hezekiah was glad of them and did a very foolish thing. He showed them the house of his precious things. And because of this, verse 5, Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of Yahweh of armies. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house, that which thy fathers had laid up in store till this day, shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing left, saith Yahweh, and of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. And the fulfillment of that is Daniel chapter 1, verse 1 and 2, where Daniel of the royal house of Judah, his three royal friends, find themselves in the house of the eunuchs in Babylon. So at this stage, Babylon, the empire, doesn't exist. It's just a city-state ruled by a vassal king, Merodach-Baladan. Now, Merodach-Baladan got carried away with his plans. In fact, he was such a pain in the neck to the Assyrians that in 705 BC, 5 years later, Sennacherib, who was the king of Assyria at the time, actually went down, utterly wiped out Babylon, completely destroyed it, burnt it to the ground, and then diverted the river over the top of it. 40 years later, the next king of Assyria completely rebuilt it. Interesting story, but we don't have time for that. So 20 years now, after Sennacherib's wiped out Babylon, got rid of Merodach-Baladan, we read in the scriptures that Sennacherib comes down from the north into the land of Israel in BC 681. Now, we all know the story. We don't need to turn it up. He left with his tail between his legs because his army is wiped out by a mysterious plague in front of the walls of Jerusalem, where it says in that beautiful wording, in the King James Version at least, they all woke up in the morning, and behold, they were all dead corpses. Now, it's recorded in the scripture and in the secular record that Sennacherib went back up to Assyria. He was murdered then by his oldest son in the temple of his god. His youngest son, Esarhaddon, was placed on the throne by his council in his stead, and his oldest son was murdered. And it turned out that this destruction of his army down there in his Jerusalem, the ensuing murder by his sons, began the beginning of the demise of the Assyrian Empire. Because in the decades after, Assyria weakened as a power systematically and ended up in a civil war that broke out in BC 635. And very rapidly, the power of Assyria began to diminish. They began internally fighting. And it created a vast power vacuum through this whole area that you see on the map here in terms of the Assyrian Empire. There was no longer a power of Assyria. Now, in that power vacuum, a number of important things occurred, as they always do in a power vacuum. First, the Scythians, the forebears or some of the forebears of the Russians, who'd been held back in the northern mountains by Assyria's military might, broke out and they swept from the north all the way down into the land of Israel. And we'll read of that in one or two of the Psalms. Almost as quickly, they went back up again as the Medes actually came in from the north and cut off their retreat area. But the other thing that happened inside this power vacuum of the Assyrian Empire was that for the very first time, a Chaldean king came to power in Babylon. Now, this is, you're not going to be able to see this, unfortunately, but this is a little map that shows the rise of the Babylonian power and the destruction of the Assyrians. So Assyria is now falling apart. They're weak. There's a power vacuum arose. And taking advantage of Assyria's weakness, a Chaldean began a revolt in the city of Babylon. He formed an army, he took control of that small state of Babylon, and he began to march north. He joined forces with the Medes and marched on Asher. He then moved to Nineveh itself, where he defeated the Assyrian army. Now, this man's name, this Chaldean's name, was Nabopolassar. Now, remember that name, Nabopolassar. Don't ask me to spell it, because he's very important to the story of Daniel. Now, the other thing that's important to the story of Daniel is Nabopolassar, this Chaldean now king, who's marched on Babylon, taking it, made himself the king of Babylon, now marching with the Medes on the Assyrian power. He had a son, and it was his son who was the general of the army now of Babylon, the Chaldeans. His son was a brilliant general, very, very smart and good at executing military strategy, and it was his son who actually led the army against the Assyrian power. Now, no prizes for guessing who the son's name was. It was Nebuchadnezzar. Now, shortly after coming to power, Nabopolassar forged that alignment with the Medes and the Elamites, and they together marched on Asher. They marched to Asher, then to Nineveh, the principal cities of Assyria, and they broke the back, the military power of the Assyrians. The Assyrians fled, and they went to all of places out to the west, to the city of Haran, and there they had their final and last battle. There the Chaldeans and the Medes and the Elamites finally destroyed the power of Assyria. And that was the end of them. Assyria was gone. But now something really interesting happens. Because while Nabopolassar, who's the victorious Chaldean king, he goes all the way back to Babylon to establish the empire, he sends his son, Nebuchadnezzar, his general, off to a little place out to the west called Carchemish. Now, why did he do that? Why did Nabopolassar go all the way back? Now he's finished the power of Assyria. He goes all the way back into Babylon, but he sends his son Nebuchadnezzar, the general now, in charge of the army of the Babylonians, Chaldean Babylonians, just a little bit further to the west to Carchemish. Well, let me tell you what he's doing. As the Assyrian power began to disintegrate into civil war, as the Chaldeans took Babylon and they hooked up with the Medes and the Elamites and marched on Asher to destroy them, there's a chappie all the way down there in Egypt called Pharaoh Necho. And he is mightily concerned about this emerging power vacuum and this coalition that he's heard of in the north. Because he knew that the next thing was they would sweep down through the Levant, in through the land of Israel, and possibly even to Egypt itself. So what Pharaoh Necho did way down in Egypt is he put his own armies together and he started moving to the north. Interestingly, actually, Pharaoh Necho, the Egyptians, and the Assyrians had a joint army base at Carchemish to keep the area of Lydia and the kings out of the area of Greece and of Turkey out of their empire. So there was a joint military base up there at Carchemish. So Pharaoh Necho puts his army together and he begins to march to the north. Now let's just take a step aside here, because while we can see the Most High ruling in the kingdoms of men, we can see the big power politics happening, we can see empires falling apart and being created, we can see power vacuums, we can see the big armies on the move, there's a whole lot going on in the nation of Israel that we all know about. You imagine that you are King Josiah, who is king at this time in the land of Israel. First of all, you know that the long-standing enemy of Israel and of Judah, the Assyrian power, this great nation that for hundreds of years has been coming down into your land, has been destroyed. It tore itself apart. Suddenly you hear on CNN of this great coalition of the Chaldeans, the Medes, the Elamites. They've formed way out to the east, and they're marching on Asher. It looks like the Assyrian power's in deep trouble. Then your spies come in from Egypt. Pharaoh of Egypt is starting to move his army north. And suddenly all the ancient telephone lines are buzzing. Nineveh's fallen. The remnant of the Assyrian armies is destroyed. The 600-year power of Assyria is no longer there. Pharaoh Necho is on the move from the south. He's crossed the Nile. Day by day, he gets closer to the borders of your land. Now, if you're Josiah, and says, what do you do? We're coming to 2 Chronicles 35, and we read there what he does. 2 Chronicles 35 records the actions of King Josiah at this time. 2 Chronicles 35, verse 19. In the 18th year, the king of Josiah was the Passover kept. After all this, when Josiah had prepared the temple, Necho, king of Egypt, came up to fight against Carchemish by Euphrates, and Josiah went out against him. But Necho sent ambassadors to him, saying, what have I to do with thee, thou king of Judah? I come not against thee this day, but against the house wherewith I have war. So he's on his way now to fight Nebuchadnezzar and the Chaldean army at Carchemish. God commanded me to make haste. Forbear thee from meddling with God who is with me, that he destroy thee not. Nevertheless, Josiah would not turn his face from him, but disguised himself to fight with him. And of course, the battle closed in the valley of Megiddo's, and the archers shot at King Josiah, and he was wounded and he died. So Pharaoh Necho brushes aside Josiah, and over the next year or so, he moves all the way up to Carchemish in the north. And here, at Carchemish, somewhere around that little tell there, on the upper boundary of the Euphrates River, the famous ancient battle of the Battle of Carchemish took place between Nebuchadnezzar II, the general of the Chaldean army, and Pharaoh Necho of Egypt. And so the power of a Chaldean Babylon suddenly rose from nowhere and splashed across the ancient world. Now, of course, Necho lost that battle, and Nebuchadnezzar chased them all the way down into the land of Israel. But he didn't end up down in Egypt, because around about that time he got news that his father Nabopolassar had died back in Babylon. Now in those days, if your father died and he was king in your next in line, then it was a very good idea to get back to that city very, very quickly. So he did. He went straight back to Babylon, became the king now, Chaldean king of Babylon, founded the Babylonian Empire. Now, we're not going to go through the rest of the history there, but 6 years later, Jehoiakim, who was then king of Judah, started getting cozy with the Egyptians again, annoyed Nebuchadnezzar, and he came down again. And in BC 598, he came against Israel. He marched down to clean up the security of his southern or southwestern border. He came into the land of Israel. He laid siege to Jerusalem, which was the principal city he needed to control at that point. And Jehoiakim the king died. His son Jehoiachin was replaced, only then to suffer defeat a few months later. And the city of Jerusalem fell, as we know, on March 16, 597. And in that city, on that day, as it fell, there was a young teenage lad, 14, 15, 16-year-old, called Daniel and his three friends, princes of Judah. And Nebuchadnezzar took them and 3,000 of the nobility, all the very best craftsmen, nobility and aristocracy, back to Babylon. And that's where we begin in Daniel chapter 1 and in verse 1. All right, we're going to jump over the Zedekiah years, because Nebuchadnezzar had to come down again and take out Zedekiah, who again tried to cozy up with Egypt. But let's just jump over that, because what I want to do now is have a look at Babylon itself. Because funnily enough, the Babylonian Empire lasted for only 86 years. For an empire that left such a mark in history, and about which we hear such a lot, it lasted for a remarkably short period of time. You know, the Assyrians lasted for 500 or 600 years. Before that, there was 1,000 years of city-states. Then Babylon, Chaldean, turns up for just 86 years. It came from nowhere. Nebuchadnezzar set up a stunning empire. And then gone like the wind, it was gone in 86 years. Now here's the 86-year potted history on the screen here of Babylon. We've already talked about Nabopolassar, the first Chaldean king of Babylon, the founder of the Babylonian Empire. We're going to call him Grandad at the top there, and he lasted for about 20 years. His son Nebuchadnezzar, the one that we all know from the book of Daniel, reigned for a highly prosperous 43 years. That's when Babylon reached its zenith. He undertook incredible building programs. He rebuilt Babylon. He established vast canal systems through the empire. He built the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon. He finished enormous temple complexes called Etamenanki, the Palace of the King, and the incredible triple fortification of the city walls, massive building, and then it all began to fall apart. After 43 years, Nebuchadnezzar died, and his son, Evil-Merodach, the grandson of Nabopolassar, only lasted 2 years before all the factions that were sitting inside Babylon who didn't like it at all disposed of him. They appointed Nergal-Sharishah, who was a son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar. He only lasted 5 years, for he was also taken off the scene, probably murdered. After a great deal of court intrigue, the kingship of Babylon left the Chaldean dynasty, and it went to a man from Haran called Nabonidus, who was made king of Babylon. Now, Nabonidus is not a Chaldean. He actually came from Haran, of all places. His mum was the priestess of the god of Haran, who was the very same god of Ur of the Chaldees, Nana, the Sin, or Shin, the moon or the cow god. So she had moved down to Babylon with her boy Nabonidus, and she became very influential and a power player in the constant court intrigues of the day. And of course, if you remember back in those days, no separation of church and state. The factions of the different gods were the political powers of the day. So she became very politically powerful. And her son, Nabonidus, so she's the high priestess of Nana or the god Shin, very politically powerful player, arranges for her son, Nabonidus, to become the king of Babylon. Now Nabonidus, funnily enough, didn't live in Babylon. He spent many of his years in Haran and also in an obscure town out in the desert. Actually appointed his son, Belshazzar that we read of in Daniel chapter 5 to be the vassal king or the caretaker king in Babylon itself. All right, well, that's Babylon. In 86 years, it was all over. Now, the question is, why? In the purpose of God, who sets up and establishes kings and kingdoms and takes them away, gives them to who he wishes, why was it in his purpose that there would be a Chaldean king who would come to power, that would take into captivity Israel, last for 86 years, and then disappear? Why Chaldeans and why Babylon? Now, this is fascinating, because keep in mind, of course, that through much of its history, Babylon had traveled through a whole lot of different powers. In fact, it was in the hands of Nimrod, the Sumerians, the Akkadians, the Hurrians, the Amorites, the Kassites, the Kadites, all controlled Babylon at different times. But right down at the end, it becomes an empire for 86 years under a Chaldean. Why? Well, it's because in the purpose of God, it was important that Judah would be taken into captivity by a power who was both Chaldean and Babylon. And I'll show you why. This is a brilliance of the mind. It gives an insight into the way that our Heavenly Father works in his dealings with the nations and his people. God raised the Chaldeans from obscurity. I'm going to give you five or six passages on screen here, and I'll read them out. You don't need to turn them up. Just show you how God worked to build this power. Isaiah 23:13. Behold, the land of the Chaldeans, this people was not, till the Assyrian found it for them that dwell in the wilderness. They set up the towers thereof and raised the palaces thereof. So the Chaldean power was known for being obscure and small and coming from nowhere. Habakkuk chapter 1 verse 6. Lo, I, God, raised up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation who will march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. So God says, I did it from obscurity, and I raised this power. So why was it important that God would raise an obscure Chaldean power into Babylon and then take Judah into captivity? Well, it's because they were Chaldean. Abraham, the land of his nativity, was from Ur of the Chaldees. And in Genesis chapter 11 and 12, I'll put this on screen too, it says these remarkable things. That Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity, Ur of the Chaldeans. Genesis 11, verse 31, Terah took Abraham his son, Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with both of them from Ur of the Chaldeans. Yahweh said to Abraham, get thee out of thy country, from thy kindred and thy father's house, to a land that I will show thee. So God raised the Chaldeans up to take Judah back to where it all began, the land of their father's nativity. Now, why would he do that? Because that's where they served other gods. Now, we've run out of time here, so I'm going to have to skip over a few of these and bring it quickly to the end. But the gods that they served on the other side of the flood were the gods Marduk and Shin. Marduk became Bel or Baal, or the forerunner of what became Zeus and Jupiter, the supreme god of the Greeks and the Roma. Shin was Nana, the god of the moon and the herdsman. And so God took them back to the land of their nativity. And so we're going to find, God willing, tomorrow as we pick up the rest of the story, that the divine title of the book of Daniel is going to become Elyon, the Most High God. And the narratives of Daniel are going to be systematically set up there to contrast a series of contests between our Heavenly Father, Elyon, the Most High God, and Marduk, or Bel, or Baal, the God of the Babylonians. And we're going to pick up the story in Daniel chapter 1, as we see these four young teenage boys snatched from the home, snatched from their parents and their ecclesias, and taken to the heart of the apostasy and the idolatry of Babylon. And we're going to see them tomorrow confronted with the choice, the great choice of life. Who is it that they are going to serve? Will it be Yahweh, the Most High God? Or will it be Marduk, or the myriad different gods of this world?